The main discussion point here is, to what extent are we endangering the balance of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere? This is the result of years of indifference toward the rise of fuel consumption by Earth's inhabitants, using fossil fuels and extracting amounts of carbon from the depths of the Earth and emitting it out into our atmosphere, with the oceans and water's low capacity in absorbing it.
Countries that produce oil and gas highly depend on oil revenues for their income. Well, if we discuss cutting emissions, that will mean reducing the production of fossil fuels, and that could somehow affect their income in the future. We humans, for our own interests, have been indifferent toward the Earth by gradually increasing the use of heating devices for transportation, as in cars, or fossil fuels that are used in industries, petrochemical refineries, powerhouses, and household fuels, and so on.
این محصول بی‌توجهی ما به حال زمین بوده.
We all breathe the same air. There may be less pollution in one place and more in another, but its effect on the environment can be hazardous for us all.
برای همه ما میتونه زیانبار و زیانبخش باشه.
Used to be so good, but my children started to forget about me. They started to only think about themselves and forgot about their mother. I don't quite understand. My greed has taken such a hold of you. My children have brought disorder to this world.
We will see many people lose their habitats due to rising seawater levels in the future.
Consider the chain of islands that make up the Maldives, which are only 1.2 meters above sea level at most. The country will lose a large portion of its land with the minutest rise in open water levels. Residential areas will be destroyed.
Many people will be unable to continue living in their own countries due to the drought and lack of water.
You pointed out to wars being fought in the future over water. Unfortunately, I have to say that these wars have already started. The future is now. Since entering the 21st century, even in our own Western region,
There have been serious challenges over water resources. So discussions about war and the competition for having access to water resources have already begun. It may not be that serious now, but be aware of its complications.
A large number of people will have to be relocated because their cities will become uninhabitable.
These people will migrate to places across the world, but these other areas do not have a high capacity either. It will be one of mankind's major problems in the future.
What does it all mean? It will mean high expenses for human living, something we never thought about. We never thought that a big city could ever become uninhabitable, a city with millions of residents, but it's happening.
The people I see, these are people, Paula, let me explain, who are people with limited resources. These are people who did not have the wherewithal to get out of town. They didn't have cars. There's no way they could pay for a hotel room. They stayed in their houses because they had to. And then the water came up, and I'm sure there were elderly here, there were infirm here. It's just horrific.
پیش‌بینی میشه که طی 15 سال آینده بر اساس بهترین برآوردهای
Based on UN estimations, it's predicted that within the next 15 years at most, between 80 and 90 million people will be displaced from small countries that are made up of chains of islands due to global warming and climate change. Then we won't be dealing with migrants and asylum seekers displaced by war and conflict. We will have migrants fleeing environmental disasters as well. So we need to make people around the world more aware of this eventuation and find a solution for it.
If I make a mistake here and go to jail, my kids and family will live the effects. I've done something wrong, but my child will feel its effects. If I make a mistake as a member of the global community, that mistake affects the whole. One multiplied by 1,000. One is a small figure. One is a small figure, but it's multiplied by 1,000. What does it equal? It equals 1,000. You have an index called M for mistake, which is a huge figure collectively. It's the mass of the entire planet. It's not at all a small figure. Now, even if you have an extremely small figure, you're multiplying it by a very large number. 1 multiplied by 1,000 equals 1,000. The 1 turned into 1,000. 2 multiplied by 1,000 equals 2,000. 3 multiplied by 1,000 equals 3,000. 0.5 multiplied by 1,000 equals 500. So we should be aware of what we're doing.
The Earth is also making all efforts to somehow balance all the noise and demands we're imposing on it. However, our power, mankind's destructive power, is now seemingly taking the upper hand over the Earth's ability to regenerate itself.
Anyways, we should know that if the doors to the future open in this way, it will lead to a grave crisis.
Thank you.
I am shivering, and I feel nauseous. My children, the economic factor is not a sustainable argument. I think about climate change and this disaster.
The components of social welfare need to be changed. The developing world should no longer be using the same criteria the developed world has defined as welfare for its people and follow their footsteps.
If we take an overall look, I think any project, any move, any industrialization, any process or any technology should calculate the temperature rise on the Earth in proportion with the delta T quotient.
Finally, humans can go on living for a week or two without food and a few days without water, but without air. We can't but survive for a minute. It is the most vital of anything the Earth's atmosphere has provided us with. We're using it, but on the other hand, we're destroying it, badly, and with high cost. We place it into a poorly manufactured man-made combustion device and receive toxic chemicals on the other side, which remains. It remains and moves around, and the Earth has no way to get rid of some of these toxic chemicals we've produced.
The economy has limited all activities to itself, and those who speak about the impact on the environment and the earth just talk and hold summits, but practically it's almost useless.
Concern. Just concern. What does that mean? What does being concerned mean? Static concern is meaningless. Concern should be dynamic. If you're concerned, you should do something to reduce that concern. That's a dynamic solution, not a static one. A static solution just adds to your concern and accumulates and is useless. Concern must be dynamic. What does dynamic mean? It means you must seek a real solution for it. It means you need to have a program.
I believe that if we carry on like this, making the earth sick and failing to do anything about this sickness, we'll be deeply ashamed in front of our next generations. They've had no role in bringing about this situation, yet they have to bear the consequences. Consequences that are getting worse by the day. So I can't do anything but apologize to the next generation who might be watching this film for the disasters that my generation is causing the environment and the earth.
I don't understand why my children are destroying the one and only home that they have. As my children, they have closed their eyes to the fact. Don't use your planet in the wrong way. We are a part of you, not separated from you.
The Earth has been stable and balanced due to its ecosystem. It carried on with its life way before we ever came along and started hurting and destroying it. Finally, just like a pendulum will do, if you place it out of balance, it will try to balance itself, reach its lowest energy level and become balanced.
The Earth is our mother. It's beautiful, it's a creator, it's merciful, and we in return are being very bad children.
Well, it's perfectly true that every single one of us citizens of the Earth must do our share to reduce pollution. But to curb global warming and avoid its dire consequences, the countries most responsible must make an effort. The U.S. has caused more global warming than any other country. Research shows that from 1850 to the year 2011, the United States, a single country, produced 27% of the total carbon dioxide emissions of the world. No other single country was even close. Indeed, the U.S. even outdistanced all the nations of the European Union combined. Well, that's a wrap for this week, but join me again next week here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
The Limelight.
Echoing calls from advocacy organizations and other surveillance critics after the Pegasus expose broke last month, a group of United Nations human rights experts have recently called for a global moratorium on the sale and transfer of surveillance technology. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, After Pegasus Exposé, UN Rights Experts Urge Moratorium on Life-Threatening Spyware. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Echoing calls from advocacy organizations and other surveillance critics after the Pegasus expose broke last month, a group of United Nations human rights experts recently called for a global moratorium on the sale and transfer of surveillance technology. In mid-July, a media consortium led by Forbidden Stories, with the technical support of Amnesty International, revealed that the Israeli regime firm NSO Group's Pegasus spyware has been used to target activists, journalists, and politicians worldwide, sparking moratorium demands. Three United Nations special rapporteurs, Iron Khan, Mary Laurel, Clement Nialitesi, along with a UN working group focused on business and human rights, joined that chorus with a long statement on the life-threatening technology. It is highly dangerous and irresponsible to allow the surveillance technology and trade sector to operate as a human rights-free zone, the UN experts warned, adding, "We are deeply concerned that highly sophisticated intrusive tools are being used to monitor, intimidate, and silence human rights defenders, journalists, and political opponents. Such practices violate the rights to freedom of expression, privacy, and liberty, possibly endanger the lives of hundreds of individuals, imperil media freedom, and undermine democracy, peace, security, and international cooperation." Their statement highlighted a 2019 UN report in which another human rights expert urged such a moratorium until countries enact human rights protections, as well as the international community's failure to heed that call. In its initial responses to the Pegasus project investigation, NSO Group pushed back, telling the consortium that It firmly denies false claims made in your report, which many of them are uncorroborated theories that raise serious doubts about the reliability of your sources as well as the basis of your story, unquote. By late July, an unnamed source within the NSO group told NPR that there is an investigation into some clients. Some of those clients have been temporarily suspended. However, the source did not share which or how many of the company's clients, intelligence agencies, law enforcement bodies, and militaries were blocked from using the spyware. The UN experts said they have been in direct contact with both NSO Group and the Israeli regime regarding the reporting. Given the extraordinary audacity and contempt for human rights that such widespread surveillance shows, they said, if the denial of collusion by the NSO Group is to have any credibility at all, the company must disclose whether or not it ever conducted any meaningful human rights due diligence in line with the UN guiding principles on business and human rights, and publish fully the findings of any internal probes it may have undertaken on this issue. The experts also called on the Israeli regime to disclose fully what measures it took to review NSO export transactions in light of its own human rights obligations, adding that it is the duty of states to verify that companies like the NSO Group do not sell or transfer technology to or contract with states or entities that are like to use them to violate human rights. The experts added, in recent years, we have repeatedly raised the alarm about the danger the surveillance technology poses to human rights. Once again, we urge the international community to develop a robust regulatory framework to prevent, mitigate, and redress the negative human rights impact of surveillance technology, and pending that, to adopt a moratorium on its sale and transfer. They noted, international human rights law requires all states to adopt robust domestic legal safeguards to protect individuals from unlawful surveillance, invasion of their privacy, or threats to their freedom of expression, assembly, and association. Other advocates for an immediate moratorium on the export, sale, transfer, and use of such surveillance technology include Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Callamard, an exiled American whistleblower, Edward Snowden, who went even further. Snowden told The Guardian last month, this is an industry that should not exist. The NSO Group is only one company of many. And if one company smells this bad, what's happening with all the others?
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Here at IRIB English Radio, we would like to express our condolences to you, our listeners, on martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions in this month of Muharram. Today we're going to be talking about the ziyarat and homage of Ashura, which is a very important ziyarat from amongst the various ziyarats that we recite. Ziyarat and the homage and the visitation of Ashura. The first question that we want to ask regarding this ziyarat is, how reliable is it? How reliable and authentic is this ziyarat? The answer to this question is that the ziyarat Ashura is one of the most authentic, the oldest and most authentic text in which this ziyarat has been transmitted to us is a book called Kamilu Ziyarat. The author of this book is a person named Jafar ibn Kulawaye Qumi. This person has related this and transmitted this ziyarat via five mediums from the fifth Imam, Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Therefore, we can say that this ziyarat has been related from Imam Baqir from five mediums in a very authentic book, and therefore it's a very reliable and authentic ziyarat that one can recite. The second question that we'd like to address regarding this ziyarat is that in this ziyarat we see that many of the enemies of the family of the Prophet alayhi wasalam have been cursed. Many people say that this cursing is something that's not suitable and not something that's not compatible with the lofty stature of the imams. So how is this reconcilable with the lofty stature of the imams? The imams were kind people, they were kind to everybody, and they were very merciful and beneficent. So how is it possible to reconcile these noble attributes with these curses that they send upon their enemies? The answer to this question is that these curses, the word lan in Arabic it refers to the intention of distancing oneself from another person. When we perform a lan on somebody, we are in effect expressing our desire to be distant from that person or that individual. At the same time, when we and this is not something that is not incompatible with the stature of the imams. At the same time, we see that in the Holy Quran, God Almighty, 37 times he performs a lan or a curse upon various individuals and groups, such as the disbelievers, the kafirin, the polytheists, the mushrikeen, the liars, and others, the kadhibin. Right. So this act of cursing, it's not something that is incompatible with the stature of the Aimah. Thank you for joining us here today on The Key. We were examining the dimensions of the Ziyarat of Ashura. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
You're listening to Hosseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Rezavian. Labbaik Ya Hussein.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alayka Ya Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam. Brothers and sisters, my sincerest condolences for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Welcome to the program, Husseiniyye. We were talking about the spiritual journey of Ziyarat Ashura, that the first station is the station of Bala, and that is the station that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam faced. That is the step that they took. Two, we talked about the station of Huzn, and that thanking Allah at the end of Ziyarat Ashura for this raziyat, for this calamity, that we thank God for being sad for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because it is ibadat, it is worship, it is tasbih, it is the glorification of God. Today we're going to talk about the third station, and that is the station of Silm and the station of Harb, meaning it is the station of peace and the station of conflict. The followers of Imam Hussein, they had to make a decision, that is to join and to be at peace with Imam Hussein and to protect Imam Hussein, or to leave Imam Hussein alone. The decision that they made changed their future, changed their essence, and they became the followers of Imam Hussein. They became the companions of Imam Hussein. They were at conflict with the opposite side, which were those that became enemies with Imam Hussein, those that became enemies with the Ahlul Bayt, those that became enemies with God. Therefore, in this station, it is the station that we read, Inni Silmun Laman Salamakum. I am at peace with he who is at peace with you. وَهَرْبٌ لَمَنْ هَارَبَكُمْ I am at war with those who fought against you. So this is the station of Silm and Harb, meaning that we enter the camp of Imam Hussein now. Now that we understood Bala, now that we understood grief, now we take ourselves and we become Husseini with our lifestyle. With the virtues that Imam Hussein alayhi salam took dear to him, we become truly Husseini. This is a more difficult station. This means that we have to let go with whatever the enemies of Imam Hussein did, whatever virtues and deficiencies they had. We separate ourselves from those bad habits, from those bad examples, and that we change our life, and that we enter the camp of Imam Hussein, and we become more like him. Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari was a companion of the Holy Prophet. And
He was one of the people that the Holy Messenger of Allah said, send my salams to Muhammad al-Baghir, which is the fifth Imam. He lived a very long life, and he saw Imam Muhammad al-Baghir, and he sent the salams, conveyed the salams of the Messenger of Allah to Imam Muhammad al-Baghir, alayhi salam. He is also one of those that reaches the grave of Imam Hussein after he's martyred. And he is there with Atiyah. And what happens is that in the tradition we have, Jabir ibn Abdullah says, لَقَدْ شَارَكْنَاكُمْ فِي مَا دَخَلْتُمْ فِي. He says that we have participated in what you have entered. We have participated. We were at Ashura. Atiyah is surprised. He's saying, we didn't fight. We didn't unsheath our swords. How can we have participated in Karbala and we weren't even there? There, Jabir ibn Abdullah says this tradition. فَقَالَ يَا عَطِيَّ سَمِعْتُ حَبِيبِي رَسُولَ اللَّهِ. He's a great companion of the Messenger of Allah. He says, يَقُولُ مَنْ أَحَبَّ قَوْمًا حُشِرَ مَعَهُ. Whoever loves a group of people with their hearts, they will be resurrected with them on the Day of Judgment. وَمَنْ أَحَبَّ عَمَلَ قَوْمٍ أُشْرِكَ فِي عَمَلِهِمْ. And if a person loves the actions of a group, he will participate and will have a share of that action. We wanted to be in Karbala. We couldn't be in Karbala. Therefore, we will be rewarded with the same reward of those that have participated in Karbala. This means that those that align themselves, they are at peace with Imam Hussein, they align their hearts with Imam Hussein, they will reap the benefits of Karbala, inshallah.
Raytheon has close ties to the Israeli military and supplies them with missiles, bombs, and other equipment, including the Iron Dome system. Anti-war group said, adding, these weapons have been linked to dozens of attacks that have killed and injured civilians. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading Anti-War Group Blocks Entry to Raytheon Facility to Protest Killing of Civilians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Group of anti-war activists blockaded the entrances to a Raytheon facility in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, recently to protest the role the weapons maker plays in the killing of civilians in Yemen, the occupied Palestinian territories, and elsewhere around the world. The demonstration was organized and live-streamed on Facebook by Resist and Abolish the Military-Industrial Complex, RAMINC, and the FANG Collective, a direct action organization based in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. In a statement, the FANG Collective pointed to a 2018 CNN report revealing that Raytheon, the second largest military contractor in the world and the largest producer of guided missiles, manufactured bombs and other munitions that the U.S.-backed, Saudi-led coalition used to kill dozens of women, children, and other civilians in Yemen. The anti-war group said Raytheon also has ties to the Israeli military and supplies them with missiles, bombs, and other equipment, including the Iron Dome system. These weapons have been linked to dozens of attacks that have killed and injured civilians. Two protesters at the Portsmouth facility attached themselves to cars to obstruct the entrances as others chanted, "Shame on Raytheon," and held banners that read, "Raytheon profits from genocide." Police officers soon arrived on the scene and extracted at least one of the protesters from a car, towing it away. Raytheon profits from the killing of civilians, families, and children in Palestine, Yemen, and elsewhere, one of the demonstrators said, adding, "We can't sit idly by. While Raytheon engineers new and more destructive ways of killing innocent people, Raytheon must be stopped and held accountable." Since 2015, the U.S.-backed Saudi-led bombing and blockade of Yemen has killed tens of thousands of people and devastated the country, creating what the United Nations calls the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Half the country's people are on the brink of famine. The country has the world's worst cholera outbreak in recorded history, and now Yemen has one of the very worst COVID death rates in the world. It kills one in four people who test positive. American weapons manufacturers like Raytheon have a vested interest in continuing the war and wield an immense amount of power in Washington. It is unlikely the U.S. regime will end the war without a fight. Starting under Obama and continuing under Trump and Biden, the U.S. have been heavily involved in the war on Yemen, primarily through weapon sales to Saudi Arabia regime and its coalition partners. These weapons are by and large used to intentionally target and kill Yemenis. This bloodthirsty logic has been a driving force behind the war for almost 6 years. Raytheon Technologies, the second largest arms manufacturer in the world, is one major provider of these weapons. It stands out from the rest of its competitors because of its close ties with Saudi Arabia regime, having been the first weapons manufacturer to build a permanent operation there in 1960s, hiring members of the Saudi royal family as consultants and opening a branch of the company in Riyadh in 2017. After the war began in March 2015, Raytheon's stock price went from about $108 to more than $180 in 2019, reflecting billions of dollars in weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. Despite the countless threats connecting Raytheon to Saudi Arabia and its financial interest in the continuing war in Yemen, the company portrays itself as a neutral force which simply carries out the foreign policy of the U.S. regime and therefore is not responsible for the destruction wrought by its weapons. When Vice President of Business Development and CEO of Raytheon Company International John D. Harris II was asked by the CNBC in a February 2019 interview about the use of Raytheon bombs in Yemen, his response was, "We are an element of U.S. policy. Our role is not to make policy. Our role is to comply with it." By characterizing itself as an obedient, law-abiding company, Raytheon not only attempts to weasel out of its culpability, but also obfuscates the horrific tragedy playing out in Yemen and other countries where its bombs fall.
This is A to Z. Today's lesson: emotional decisions versus informed decisions. Suleiman ibn Surada Khudai knew well that the sentiments of the people at that time could not be relied upon, because it might so happen that if Hussein ibn Ali rose against Banu Umayya later and they employed their full strength to kill him and rendering him help became something dangerous, the same people might turn away their faces from him, ignore the letters written by them, close their doors in the face, and even join the enemies. They might consider it a religious duty to kill Imam Hussein alayhi salam and might put him and his friends to sword to gain the pleasure of Allah and His Prophet. And after killing those godly persons, they might stand and cry, "Allah is the greatest. I testify that there is no God but Allah, and I testify that Muhammad is His Prophet," as if they had committed no sin at all. It was for this reason that he explained the position to the distinguished supporters and said, "Even now you should judge the results in your mind and visualize the situation which is bound to arise, and then decide whether you can make him hopeful, and make Imam Hussein alayhi salam hopeful of your assistance, and invite him to Iraq with perfect confidence and final determination. It should not be that today, when your sentiments are roused, you should be writing letters, making covenants, and taking oaths, and pull the son of the Prophet of Allah from Allah's sanctuary to Iraq. But tomorrow, when the enemy surrounds him and compels him either to take the oath of allegiance or lose his head, you should desert him and forget the promises made by you." The distinguished supporters replied with one voice, "We are prepared to perform jihad and make sacrifices, and shall lay down our lives for the sake of our Imam." Thereupon Suleiman said, "In that case, you should write a letter to the Imam."
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله
وعلى أرواحنا.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Before the break, we gave you a historical account of Suleiman ibn Surada Khudai and the companions, or rather the supporters of Hussein ibn Ali, who were ready to write him the letters. And Suleiman gave them a few pieces of advice, which is very interesting. So let's try to draw a few lessons from this whole historical account. Lesson number one is that the Imam received 17,000 plus letters, okay? According to some historical accounts, there are other historical accounts which say 12,000 plus. You know, there are different numbers, but we know for sure that it was in the ballpark of this 15, 17,000, 12,000, 14,000, something like that. The question is, you all know the history of Karbala. Where did they all go? Why is it that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was left with barely 70 odd people with him? And that included women and children. Where did all these 17,000 people who wrote the letters went? This is something for us to understand and realize. It is one thing to be emotional and decide something, and it is something else to make a decision that we call as an informed decision. Lesson number two: decisions made in an emotional state can be detrimental. Well, just go retrospectively, look at this whole event of Karbala. If these people would not have written the letters to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, it can be easily said that Imam Hussein alayhi salam may have chosen a different strategy, a different approach. But because of these letters and this emotional support that was provided and that was claimed for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he had to make the move. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
But anyone stay here won't be left tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has highlighted the unreliability of foreign providers of COVID vaccines to Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei said foreign providers of the vaccines initially reneged on their promises and refused sales. But things began to change course after Iran successfully managed to produce jabs against the deadly virus at home. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a televised speech on Wednesday amid a deadly pandemic wave that has gripped the country. Fortunately, the production of vaccines within the country paved the path for the import of foreign shots as well, whereas before that, foreign suppliers would renege on their promises despite having received the payments. The leader called on the executive bodies to double their efforts to procure vaccines, whether imported or domestically developed, and made them available to everyone.
We always have to look to the source of problems in the Middle East, and that is usually either the United States or Israel. In this case, I think we can see, or say fairly safely, that the United States is pressuring other countries not to sell vaccines to Iran in order to pressure Iran to re-enter the JCPOA. This is going to be a failed strategy, really failed strategy by the United States, which has never understood people's loyalty to their own government and has tried to bribe or intimidate countries to do the United States' bidding.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed an initiative by President Ebrahim Raisi to set a one-week deadline for proposals on a comprehensive national response to the current peak of the outbreak. He said the response to the issue should be carefully weighed and any necessary measures adopted and enforced accordingly.
This is another example of that. By preventing other countries from selling vaccines to Iran, U.S. hopes that Iran will agree to concessions to rejoin the JCPOA, this simply isn't going to happen.
Iran is one of the few countries which has been able to produce vaccines against the deadly COVID virus. After a year of intensive research using all internal resources and expertise, Iran joined the handful of countries that produced the coronavirus vaccine. The Ministry of Health later approved the Coviran Barakat vaccine that was jointly developed by Barakat Pharmaceutical Group and Shifa Pharmed Industrial Group. Iran's flagship coronavirus vaccine has hit a production milestone of 5 million doses nearly a month after it was approved for emergency use in the country. Iran has accelerated its inoculation drive against the coronavirus since earlier this month, after the health ministry announced that it can rely on abundant supplies of foreign jabs, as well as regular deliveries of vaccines that are being manufactured inside of Iran. The government says that it is determined to launch the production lot of domestic jabs, but stresses that vaccines must be imported from other countries to save people's lives. Knowledge-based companies, and especially those active in nanotechnology, are playing a major role in helping the vaccine production companies.
This is definitely an example of that, where U.S. sanctions once again have injured innocent people. We remember back in the early part of the millennium when Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State, was asked if the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children were worth U.S. sanctions. And she said, yes, it was. That's the U.S. attitude. The U.S. government does not care about the suffering of people.
Iran managed to produce vaccines despite being under cruel U.S. sanctions. The sanctions seriously undermined Iran's ability to battle the pandemic.
Iran could certainly have dealt with this this pandemic much better than it was able to had the illegal and unjust sanctions not been issued. But Donald Trump issued them, violating international law and U.S. law by doing so when he violated the JCPOA. And the United States once again has blood on its hands, this time blood of innocent Iranians who would have been able to get the vaccine had the sanctions not existed.
The cruel and illegal sanctions denied Iran access to crucial raw material and necessary equipment.
A controversial photo taken at the Russian embassy in Tehran has angered Iranians. The picture posted online by the Russian embassy this week has drawn widespread criticism and growing calls for an official apology. The controversial photo depicts Russian Ambassador Levan Jagarian and his British counterpart Simon Shercliffe sitting on the porch of the embassy with a third empty chair. It clearly echoes a photo taken in 1943 of Allied leaders Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt at exactly the same location. The Allied leaders met at the Tehran Conference to coordinate strategy against Nazi Germany. At the time, Iran was occupied by Russian and British forces despite its neutrality in the Second World War.